Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
You know, it's interesting. There are times in everyone's life when they stop and they think, why am I so lucky? How did I get here? How did this happen to me? Why am I so fortunate to have had this specific opportunity? And I actually had that thought just recently when I was informed that I had the opportunity to interview on this radio show John DeLancey. You know, John DeLancey, Q from Star Trek, The Next Generation, Donald Margolis from Breaking Bad, and he's been in a ton of other stuff over the past, 40 years? Well, he is an atheist. He's going to be on stage at the Reason Rally June the 4th, and next Tuesday, he's my guest on the radio. Gonna try not to fanboy too much. You know what I'm saying? Gonna try to be cool. Gonna try to just play it cool. Hey, John, how's it going? It's great to talk to you, John. So you don't believe in gods, huh? You're a rationalist, huh? You're gonna be at the Reason Rally, huh? That's very interesting. The entire time I'm having this conversation, on the surface, underneath, I'm gonna be like this. Oh my God, it's John DeLancey. I can't believe it. I'm going to try to be cool. But it's a big deal. You know, it's an amazing thing. And kudos to him for generously agreeing to be on the radio. That's coming up next Tuesday night. So mark it on your calendar and I'll make sure and get the word out before that broadcast goes to air. Today's show is a conversation between myself and Alex Jules. Alex is an activist. He's a writer. He is an atheist, former believer, now atheist. He is the president of Black Nonbelievers of Dallas, Texas. I took a 3-camera setup down to Dallas. We rented out Dallas Photo Studio and did a formal interview right there in the studio. And there's video of it. It looks great. You can check it out. The video link is in the description box of this show. And we spent, and we could have talked for probably an entire afternoon, but we spoke for about an hour about some very sticky subjects, specifically relating to religion and race in the year of Donald Trump. Now, I don't know if it's really the year of Donald Trump, but we must admit that Trump dominates the headlines. He's certainly dominating the Republican presidential ticket, much to the alarm of a great many of us. And Alex Jules, as you'll hear in the conversation, actually attended a Trump rally, and then he talks about what he experienced there. It's just fascinating stuff. And he's a hugely impressive guy. So anyway, that conversation is tonight's broadcast. I'm going to kick that off here in just a second. First, let me say a huge thanks to our show sponsor tonight. It's evolvefish.com. Pretty much everything at Evolve Fish, and they have a ton of products. Apparel, emblems, jewelry, drinkware, stickers, magnets, and more. Bearing a ton of different types of messages. Atheist messages, secular messages, humanist messages, political humor, other types of messages. Almost everything on the website is a conversation starter, okay? Everything from the trilobite necklace pendant or the t-shirt Aaron Ra wore on the Unholy Trinity. You saw him in Australia walking around with his shirt and it said, "There is no God but Allah." Just kidding, there is no God. They've got that shirt. The window sticker that says, "One Nation Undereducated." They have the Jesus fish emblem, except it's upside down and it has bite marks all over it. It's called fish food. They've got mugs and other merchandise bearing the logos of many of your favorite secular sites and shows, including The Thinking Atheist. They've got our coffee mug and beer glasses. They've got shot glasses, The Thinking Person t-shirt, and a whole lot more. For a limited time, Thinking Atheist wine glasses. They're really cool engraved wine glasses. Essentially, they're 2-for-1, right? 2 engraved wine glasses for $19.99. So check out a great organization, a great website, and a lot of great conversation-worthy products at Evolve. evolvefish.com. That's evolvefish.com. Alex Jules is a secular activist. He's a writer and he's president of Black Nonbelievers of Dallas, Texas. He chairs the Dallas-Fort Worth Coalition of Reason's Diversity Council. He's a founding member of the Fellowship of Free Thought, and he's an advisor to the Council for Secular Humanism's African Americans for Humanism initiative. His atheism and his activism have gained national attention. And my conversation with Alex Jules is our broadcast today. Alex Jules, you are an atheist. You are an activist. You are, in the eyes of some people, someone who's betrayed not just God, but you betrayed your race. You betrayed your culture. I want to start there. I mean, to come out as an atheist is one thing. To come out as black atheist. Now you're looking at several shades of sort of rejection and condemnation. You want to speak to that at all?
Yeah. I think I said a couple of years ago, when you there can be a separation of church and state, but when you come out as a black atheist, there's never really a separation of church and race. And the unfortunate reality for many African Americans who have had their identity stripped from them, they've had years of trying to cohere and recreate what that identity means. And right now, that means you have to be some level of theist. You have to be Christian, you have to be Muslim, maybe Muslim. You kind of get a pass on Muslim, especially with the contributions that we've had from Islam and Black Islam specifically. In the civil rights movement, but you have to believe in something because that's how we now define what blackness is. It is semi-monolithic.
Is it because there's a perception that, you know, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and other iconic figures who waved the banner of faith were so instrumental during the civil rights movement? They've sort of linked God and church and church clergy, those types of things, with the rights of people of all colors? Is it something else?
I think they're very much attached. When you take a look at the story, the Exodus itself, African Americans in particular do identify with it. You know, who was the Moses that led their people or led his people out of slavery? It's kind of the same thing. So you now have a new Moses. You have a black Moses, and that's Martin. Now, of course, there were several people beforehand that contributed to that movement. But again, when you take a look at how tied to the church that message is, freedom, regardless of the dichotomous nature of it, the duplicitous nature of it, quite honestly, you can almost dismiss part of it and say, yeah, it was used to help enslave us. However, look at what's happened. So it's very much the cherry picking that you tend to see in Christianity anyway, right? We don't talk about the bad stuff. So why not create this hero or these hero figures that are always tied to this message of freedom and salvation? So I think it's more tied to that than anything else.
Why do you think there's such an ignorance about the secular activists, those who were critical of the church, who were instrumental in helping people to achieve at least a greater degree of human rights and equality?
I think that's done on purpose. I really do. And when we talk about who is critical or who has been critical of the church, if you spend time just reading any of Martin's real critical pieces, including the letter from the Birmingham jail, you'll see that he's extraordinarily critical of the church. Langston Hughes, critical of the church. Just about most of the black activists that are tied to the civil rights have almost always been critical of the church. And that's the part of the story or the narrative that just falls off. And I think that it's being consciously done.
Do you have a history in religious belief?
I grew up very religious.
I mean, tell me about it. Were you Sunday church, Wednesday church, what?
And it was Sunday, it was Wednesday, it was Thursday, it was Friday, it was Saturday and Sundays.
What did you do there 5 days a week? I mean, was it one of those things where they just had an activity every day, like a prayer breakfast, there's a function of some kind, or was it all just church?
It was about saving people for me. Honestly.
You were evangelical.
I was Catholic, But it was a very different kind of Catholicism. I grew up in New York, and my ancestry is West Indian. So it's not abnormal to actually see that in places like New York or the West Indies, where you see Catholicism. And my ancestry in particular is from Haiti and the Dominican Republic. So during my childhood, I saw a lot of misery, you know, when my parents came from the island. And during the Duvalier regime, we had a lot of refugees that were still coming over to New York, Brooklyn specifically. And we had a lot of church outreach programs that were very real, and they had impact on people. And it was important to me, you know, growing up in a socioeconomically depressed or disadvantaged area in Brooklyn, to welcome people that had it worse off than even, you know, many of my Black peers, you know, growing up there. And the church did so much outreach at that point, and, you know, it was something that I found was extraordinarily important for me. You know, it helped give meaning to my life, right? Whether it was a crying mother who had to leave their kid, or a child who had to leave their father behind, or whether it was, okay, you were hungry before, and now you're here, and now you're in a semi-pseudo war zone in Brownsville or East New York, especially during the 80s, very early 80s and 90s. Yes, you lost your kid, but you can eat now. So we deal with so many complex issues there that, you know, I grew up wanting to be a priest because that was the image that I saw. You know, God was kind of sort of there, but very absent. But the real hands of religious people helping other people was instrumental in shaping who I was going to be as an adult. And so for years, you know, from I think I told my mother at the age of 7, might have been younger, I think it was 7 when I said, I'm going to be a priest. And that was it. And she lit up. My grandmother was like, yes, that's great. That's wonderful. Because we also have a family with a political background. And so we saw a lot of the pain, and we tried to change a lot of what was happening in the country. But money, corruption, and war tends to win out when you have people in power.
How does Mom feel about Alex 2.0, man?
Doesn't like it.
Mom, I'm no longer a devout Catholic. Oh, and I'm also going to directly challenge Catholicism and probably the Pope, I'm sure. And what are your thoughts on Pope Francis? what do you think? You know, a lot of people love the guy. What do you think?
You know, I grew up with Pope John Paul, and I thought he was the best thing ever. I was like, wow, this guy is semi-progressive. But of course, that's based on your vantage and your viewpoint, right? And when you don't know anything else, you're going to be okay with that. When I became an atheist, I think I talked to my mom, I think I was about 21, 22, when I really started having my crisis of faith. And when I would tell her that I had this real crisis, and of course it started in high school, I would actually say it started well before then, when I would actually have questions that would just go unanswered. I was very fortunate where I was able to go speak to rabbis. Growing up in New York, you have access to all kinds of religious literature and religious leaders, and they will open up their doors and talk to you. So I spoke to imams, I spoke to rabbis, I spoke to my priest when he didn't have answers. And if it wasn't okay in my parish, I would go elsewhere. I mean, a dollar would get you almost anywhere in the city, right? And you could almost go into any ghetto and have a different kind of conversation. And that was something that was very intriguing to me. So I left. I left seeking answers, and I couldn't find them. I actually converted for a split second to Islam because Catholicism, and she was okay with that. She supported that.
Mom was okay with Islam.
Mom was okay with Islam. Mom was okay with Islam because I still believed.
Now, what year was this roughly? I mean, how many years ago?
Oh, this was in the 90s.
I mean, because now if you had had that conversation in the shadow of ISIS,
it would be a very
because now when Islam is thrown out there, radical Islam is automatically part of that conversation for most people. I mean, she probably wouldn't have gone over quite as well in the year 2016.
That's right. Yeah. So this was 1990.
At least he believes in God.
At least I believe in God, and that's okay. And for a lot of African Americans in general, that's okay. So, you know, as long as you don't go out of bounds, you're all right. And you can even be a Doubting Thomas, right? But the second you cross that line, you become an Uncle Tom.
So if you say, I'm going through a journey down, I have questions, that's okay.
We all have questions. We all have questions. And as long as you stay within the field, it's okay.
I've been in the valley too, son.
Exactly.
And I know Jesus or whoever is going to take you through and you'll end up
in supposed to be there.
You'll be in the promised land one day with us all.
Exactly.
Mom, I'm an atheist. Is that how it went? Did you say, Mom, I'm an atheist?
I was spiritual first. I needed that buffer. I had to be spiritual and not religious. And of course, the question was, what do you mean by not religious? Well, I'm not okay with what religion teaches. I don't subscribe to any theistic dogmas. And she's like, do you still accept, you know, my Lord and Jesus? And I really avoided it for a while. And it was September 13th. I think it was September 11th, actually. And I said, yeah, I think I'm done now.
Of what year now, roughly?
It was September 11, 2001. 9-11. I was dancing along those lines, right? I knew I was an atheist. I didn't want to say it, right? And people around me knew I was an atheist. It's like, when's the last time you've been to church, right? When's the last time I've read all the Bibles. I've read every sacred book out there. I read The Pearl.
Well, they're always kind of taking your temperature at some point, and you become a pet project, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Everybody pray for Alex. He's going through a journey, you know?
I'm not exaggerating. I think I had about 7 pounds of Watchtower magazines.
Watchtower?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, well, just because, right? I mean, they would come in, and we'd have conversations, and they didn't have the answers. I had a lot of questions, and they didn't have answers. So I'm like, oh, but let's have a conversation anyway. Right. So, yes, I had tons of Watchtower.
On top of not believing, then, you seem to have always had an activist nature, though, right?
I did.
You want to get your fingers in the mix. You want to be a part of positive change. And that continues now. So I throw the words social justice warrior at you. I mean, someone posted something. I'm trying to think of what it was. SJW in relation to me. And I thought to myself, I have no idea how to respond to it because they have no idea how to define it.
And that's the problem. That's exactly the problem. Because a few years ago, I would even say 4 or 5 years ago, someone would throw that at me. I'm like, really? Did I earn that? Right? Yeah. Because my definition of social justice warrior, that was Malcolm, and that was Martin, that was Angela Davis. I mean, I've got list of social justice warriors, people that wanted positive change and saw the discrepancies of how justice was applied across society. That's kind of how we define what social justice is. And if you are an equality-based person or someone that wants to focus on flattening out, quote-unquote, privileges, right, you should want to stand for social justice. Why would you not? So it means something very different to me, but the words become anathema. It's been poisoned. And it's been poisoned because of taking a lot of the extremes and the exceptions and saying that that's what it is. It's very much like trying to call all of Christianity, you know, Westboro, right? We know that's not true. And Westboro may have a point, right? And they have very valid concerns about their theology and the purity of their level of Christianity.
Some could argue Westboro is actually practicing a more literal and correct version of Christianity, right?
I absolutely agree. You know? And then when you take a look at some of the conversations that happen with on campuses, for instance, because that's a big one, right? You seem to find a lot of extremes, or what you think are extremes, when you don't look at the entire context, right? I grew up in a very misogynistic society. Culturally, it was all about misogyny. We were dropping the N-bombs, we were dropping the F-bombs, it was very homophobic as well. It was just part of the noise. So all of these biases that I was inheriting, they were culturally inherited biases. And if there wasn't someone that was going to stand up and say, wait a minute, and challenge me and say, is this right? Right? Do you really consider yourself the N-word? Do you really consider? That was all brought about because of changes or challenges from social justice warriors. And so even now when people say, are you tone policing? Are you policing people's words? Even in good company, do I really want someone to call me a nigger?
When we did the radio show on black secularism, I want to say it's been a couple of years, that we spoke about the quote-unquote N-word. And I think someone had said, well, go ahead and just say it. And I literally thought, it's not a word that I don't really want it to be used. I want it to be used as little as possible. But I don't know what the response is to that, Do we just say it outright to be able to properly address it? Or do I say, I want to protect my platform from that kind of toxicity?
Yeah.
Right. And, it's a difficult thing to approach. The N-word is, how is it in some circles a term of affection? How does this happen, Alex?
This is, you can say, how can a God that was okay with your enslavement, okay with freeing you? It's the same type of dissonance. Unfortunately, especially in African American culture, Black America, because you didn't have a whole lot of power to make it go away, I think there was the compromise to accept it and try and take the power away from it, and yet still police and ban certain people from using it.
So you use it your way, but we're going to use it our way.
Right. When you can't get rid of it outright. And I think a lot of people know instinctively, deep down, that no, you still don't have the power to get rid of it, even if you wanted to. It's kind of interesting because during the, I want to say late 80s and early 90s, where almost the golden era of hip hop, we were seeing a real conversation about how do we get rid of this in our cultural dialogue, in the discourse, because we would hear it on the radio, kind of, sort of, but we were being challenged on, do you really want to use that? Is this what you consider yourself? And on the East Coast, and this is where some of the East Coast, West Coast stuff really comes into play, we were challenging whether you were ever going to use it again. And then, lo and behold, there's a group that comes out of the West Coast. Not only do they embrace it, it's in their name, right? And then all of a sudden it becomes, completely okay. Look, they're calling themselves it. And it's like, well, but what about everyone else who wants to get rid of it? And then, of course, you have the free speech activists that would say, they can say it. You are okay with not to say it, but you can't police what people say or think or do, et cetera. As long as it's not illegal.
If you're going to defend the best of speech, you must also defend the worst of speech, kind of thing. Do you in any way embrace the word?
No, none whatsoever. I think it's an ugly word.
That's probably the biggest thing for me. It has such a long history of divisiveness and ugliness and division and hatred. Even if someone's saying, I want to take it back, I just have a hard time thinking of any context where it works like that,
I like to think about it as a word that really does separate us, and it dehumanizes me, because if you look at me as just another human being, and I don't classify you as anything, you don't classify me as anything. If you're a police officer, it's a lot harder for you to shoot another human being. It's a lot easier to shoot a nigger. Hmm.
There are some who say that I'm not qualified or as qualified to be a part of the conversation because I'm you know, I was born in the United States, because I have, I mean, not just white skin, but so bright white, you could probably land aircraft with me. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah,
I haven't lived the life of someone who has faced discrimination because of their color. I can't speak to it firsthand. In many ways, I'm struggling to relate to it, yet I'm desperate to be a part of the conversation about social justice, about equality, whatever you want to call it. There are unequal things happening. There is discrimination and bigotry happening. There are people cordoned off from opportunities because of their race or because of their ethnicity, because of this, because of that. I just want to see us as the human race, if you'll forgive the cliche, right? How do I, as someone who can't speak to it firsthand, participate without totally coming off like a fake? You know, I mean, what do I do? I'm always going to be in the outside in. Can I help make a difference and how, you know?
Yeah. And that's always the struggle, because you're going to struggle with it on your side. You're going to struggle with it on my side. But because there's so much anger, right? There's so much real anger that exists between the races today. We see it in the rise of Trump, right?
Yeah.
You know, I Trump is perfect. Trump is absolutely perfect, because I take a look at a lot of my friends who say, I don't understand how this is happening. It's like, okay, these are all my white friends who are saying that. All my black friends is like, told you, right?
Just and a matter of time.
It was just a matter of time. And I tell my white friends, like, if you cannot understand how Trump came to power, then you haven't been listening to your black friends. You've been ignoring them. Because we've been taught that's the America that I've always lived in. Right? So this does not surprise me at all.
All right, so you give me few seconds. Give me your take on Trump. Trump happens. Why?
I went to a Trump rally.
Where?
In Fort Worth.
Okay.
In Fort Worth. It was an amazing experience.
I'm sure you blended right in.
Right in. And there were other black people there.
Okay.
They were selling wares, believe it or not. And I would walk up to them and was like,
vendors?
Hey, vendors. Okay. So here's the thing, right? I would walk up to them and was like, hey, are you like, no, but I got to make some paper. I was like, he'd be so proud of you. Because that's the kind of capitalistic, you know, entrepreneurship.
Targets of opportunity, right?
Absolutely. Everyone
born
loved
every
that.
Minute kind of
so,
thing.
Right. So there were no actual black supporters there, but there were other black people there. And none of them were inside. And I actually went inside and got to hear it. And what was surprising was the normalcy of that entire thing. Because I expected to see hoods and angry people. No, I saw doctors. I saw lawyers. I saw businessmen, big business, small business, just everyone, a cross-section of mostly white America, but it was a cross-section of America. And I think that a lot of people are ignoring that, right? When you listen to the media, they paint them as you know, lower IQs and blah, just angry white people. It's like, yes, they are angry white people, generally speaking, and the issue is, they're seeing some of their power, whether it's actual power or in their voices, being diminished because things are being equaled out, or people are asking that those voices be elevated to the same level. And that's problematic. If you've been in a position of privilege, equality feels like oppression. I tell that to my Christian friends all the time.
That's a t-shirt.
It is a t-shirt, yeah.
That's fantastic. It first played the cult of personality card when it came to Trump. What the terrifying thing that I often hear in my circles is, yeah, he's an asshole, but at least he's not afraid to speak his mind.
Right.
And I think to myself, is that really the qualification you want for the commander in chief of the United States?
Able to speak his mind. How about control of the tongue so that we don't
ugly,
wind up in...
But he's different.
But he's different.
And I don't know that he's all that different. You know, we're talking about big money, big power. I myself wonder if a guy like him can function in any environment where compromise is king. How do you go from a dictatorial position with your name on everything to a place where everything has to be submitted to a committee for a vote? I think the guy's head will pop off.
Do you remember Ghostbusters, the movie Ghostbusters 2?
I do.
Everyone is talking about, oh, he's the next Hitler, he's Mussolini, he's a fascist. Like, No, you got it wrong. You got it wrong. Because, yes, those were cultive personalities that were able to move people. No. Donald Trump is a result of. He is a result of. And so I want you to think about Ghostbusters 2, this sea that was running under New York City of anger and depression and just animosity and hatred that gave rise to Vigo the Carpathian.
That's a great reference.
Actually the right way of painting what Donald Trump is.
There's an undercurrent of mood slime.
Yeah.
That's just always there.
Hence, you have Vigo.
I see. X bonus points for that pop culture reference, by the way. I'm going to go see the new Ghostbusters that's coming out with, I can't remember the cast, Kristen Wiig and several others are in it. You know, you just never know. I'm digressing, but I've come to the point in my life when I look at entertainment and I say, there is nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
I'm looking for fresh ideas, those types of things. So on a personal note, you're obviously a fitness guy. I'm just saying.
Me? Yeah, just a little bit, yeah.
I'm pretty cut too. I just hide it under a protective layer.
Yeah.
Just for, you know, I just don't want to do that to my wife bought me a Fitbit. I have no idea how accurate or inaccurate these things are, but I will say that today I have walked about 700 steps. And the goal I think is like 10,000.
So, it is 10,000.
Whatever, yeah.
And I do this to not maintain my personal health. I told this to a friend of mine. And you know they've been walking ever since. I've seen friends die and not be able to get organs, and I'm a donor. I'm 100% donor. Everything goes. And so going back to you know who I am is I don't look at this as my temple. It's a storage unit, right? That I am taking care of. And if I were to die tomorrow, I want to make sure that everything that I've got can be used to save a life.
How do I get on your list, man? You got genetics or something going for you.
Oh, I have terrible genetics.
I've got a trainer, but I don't look like you.
I
look like Ferris Bueller, for God's sake.
Terrible, terrible genetics. I was a chubby kid. I was a fat kid. I was kind of round. I wasn't way overweight, but I was kind of round.
So you're saying you have to work pretty hard to be able to get where you're at.
I do.
Become a slave to the gym at some point? Do you enjoy it?
When it becomes habitual, then it's better. I don't spend, believe it or not, no more than an hour.
An hour once a day?
Once a day. Once
well,
a
that's
day.
Who some of it sounds like a hell of a lot
it,
of time.
It does, but it's, you know, if someone said that I could get on a treadmill or go to the gym and spend no more than an hour while I'm listening to Seth.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I'll slip you the 20. I'll give you my Amex number after the interview is over. And,
yeah. Like, come on.
I know it feels good when you're done. Does some of that speak to you? Like, I'm going through the, I'm not getting any younger.
Yeah.
You know, I'm metabolism's not getting any faster.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Do you have those thoughts about, do you get philosophical about life and death? And, you know, you think about those types of things, aging and
how different
you are today than you were. Like, I look at myself now as opposed to 25 years ago, and I feel like that other guy's a stranger. Like, and, I mean, he's me, but whoa.
Uh-huh.
So much has changed.
And I have children. I have five children. Five. And so when I start talking about my religious background, I'm like, okay, I know you were Catholic. I know you did the Muslim thing. Were you also Mormon? No.
I'm going to come back. We didn't finish our conversation about the Pope, and I know I left some people hanging. I want your take on Pope Francis, but first you mentioned the kids. How do you approach your non-belief with the kids? Is it all religion stupid kids, or is it more of a, this is your journey to take on your terms? What are you doing?
It is, but I support them I support the non-belief. One of the things that was very important to me was you have to be able to have conversations with Christians. This is not a Christian nation, but it has a whole lot of Christians here. So we do spend time looking at the Bible, reading the Bible, understanding the Bible, because what kind of dialogue can you have if there's a reference about Jonah, you know, and you have a kid who's not literate, in the Bible at all. They're going to be completely left out. So I think it's important that they see it. And I, you know, my kids do go to church every once in a while with their friends. My family knows not to try and
do that. I would think Grandpa and Grandma would really want to get those kids in church, not to pry too deeply into their personal lives.
They did. They have. And when my kids, you know, she's now 17, grabs a Bible and says, "Yeah, I'll go with you." It's like, okay, let's talk about how exactly should we be and treat a slave?
I love it. Right? They probably know more about the Bible before they walk through
the doors. Before they walk in, exactly.
Than most of the cultural Christians who are standing there nodding because they've made emotional connection to the idea of Christ and Christianity, right?
Right.
Do you do like a comparative religions thing? Do you dip your toe and do, what was that great line? I probably use it to the point where people, I probably use it too much, but the line, teach a child one religion, you indoctrinate them, you teach them all religions, you inoculate them. And I think, God, you know, if I had taken a comparative religions class that wasn't debate training, but it was actually an objective class, I might have been an atheist a few decades earlier.
The funniest thing, I have a neighbor who was a Fox News Christian.
Oh, right? that's another t-shirt.
That's a special guy. She's a Fox News Christian. And we lived next to each other for years. And she just automatically assumed that I was Christian. And I never talked about, we talked about religion all the time. And she'd bring up verse and what have you. I'm like, yeah, we could talk about it. And she never asked me what my belief was. She just assumed that I was Christian. Like, of course, you know so much about the Bible. Why wouldn't you be Christian, right? I mean, how else are you going to get it? And a couple of years into it, I think it was a billboard. And I had news vans that were coming in and out and wanting to interview me. And
this was it like a Freedom from Religion billboard?
It was the African-American billboard back in 2011.
What did the billboard say?
Doubts about religion, you're not alone.
Okay.
So I have that one, and then I did there was me and Langston Hughes on the billboard for, yeah.
Wow.
That got me death threats like crazy, and it was just insane.
Death threats?
Oh, yeah, death threats. You know, I thought I was going to have to.
Your family starts to worry a little bit about you?
We were concerned for a while because we were getting, you know, I've been really active, I want to say, since about 2011. When I did an article or I was covered in Ebony Magazine, of course, that's something that's so taboo but it's a publication of a million or more. Right?
Almost right? Entirely religious then.
It is. So they were trying to find a black atheist to interview, and they could only, at that time, I was it. Mm. There was no one else who was being vocal about it. And they found me and said, we want to interview you. And so they did. And Ebony Magazine, it was one of their anniversary specials, and it went out. Of course, it went out to the jails. It's everywhere. It's a prolific black magazine. And I started getting not just emails, but mail from jail and stuff like that, where people were like, oh.
They were going to cleanse you from the earth in the name of God.
That's right.
That'll flat keep you up at night. Because it's not just about you then, it's about your kids.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And in fact, we had a really big scare because I had a friend who was also associated with me and some of the organizations, and they sent mail to his house, and he was completely unlisted. He had literally moved 2 weeks before, and death threats, or actually just really, you know, threatening mail made it to his home. And I'm like, how exactly did they get this? And, you know, we had to call the warden, and we're trying to figure out where all this was coming from. This was a couple of years ago, and so things have kind of mellowed out a little bit. But occasionally, I'll still get stuff from even that article. Sometimes I'll get really great, positive ones. In fact, on my keyboard at home, there was a gentleman who was incarcerated. He was a Christian, and he found his atheism in jail. Now, he's not getting out until 2020, but he occasionally will send me you know, a note here or there. Thank you very much for doing this, and you've kind of helped put me on.
That's kind of a reverse of the usual story, isn't it? They go to prison and then they find God.
Yeah, right. But for him, it was, why would God let me make the decisions if he's really, you know, going to be part of my life? How would he let me get there? Why would he allow me to make all these bad decisions? And then he just started asking more questions, and through revelation, he did that. Now, you also have a lot of African-Americans who are pseudo-religious, especially when you take a look at some of the outskirts of maybe the 5% nation or the Nation of Gods or even the Nation of Islam, where they reject the supernatural portions of religion and Islam, if you want to, you know, lump that together. Now, if you're truly Muslim, you don't want that lumped together because the 5%ers have been classified as a hate group. However, if you start looking at those numbers, in particular in jail, you know, do they believe in the idea of a sky daddy or ghost or anything like that? Like, no. And so they are pulling. There's just all this other baggage that comes with their message, which is upsetting and bigoted and hateful and racist.
So back to the Pope.
Back to the Pope. Back to the Pope.
I just want to throw it back there real fast. I saw in our recent article, and he was, he seems to be, it's funny, he's like two people. He's, you know, there's one Pope that seems, he seems genuinely compassionate, and he's like he cares, and that he's willing to push the envelope, and he's willing to stand against the status quo, and he seems to be accepting, for lack of a better word, of people that the church doesn't have a history of accepting. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, then he'll turn around and say the most heinous, ridiculous thing, you know, and then he goes back to being accepting and caring. There's a lot of me that kind of likes a lot about Francis.
Yeah.
At the same time, we're talking about the quarterback for a multi-billion dollar religious corporation that has a history of bigotry, discrimination, corruption, and all sorts of crazy shit.
That's right.
And so, I mean, I don't know what to do with the guy. You know, what's your take?
He's hard because he's easy to relate to, especially with my background. I'm like, this is what he's doing. He's doing this because he's generally motivated to try and help people. And I'm like, yes, right? A hero from the people, for the people. And you look at his background in particular, it's like, well, you know, he's been on the streets, you know, doing some of the street priesthood or street, you know, hands and what have you. In fact, he's washing people's feet, right, at the Vatican, and this is the meek, and part of me wants to go out there and hug him, but he's an example of good people doing bad things in the name of God, and that's where that line just is just it never goes away, and so I want to say yes, great, wonderful, but I can't excuse what he says or sometimes what he does. And say, well, that's God's fault. And so I almost have to always put the Catholic Church in general in its own corner. It's in its own box. And I like I said, I really want to like him, but it is a money-generating engine, right?
Almost completely insulated,
yeah.
You know, and then with the institutionalized cover-ups of abuse and all these other things, even when they come forward from a position of leadership and speak, quote-unquote, speak out against it, it seems to be ineffectual. It's
you know, it's kind of like politics, right? And I have so many friends, I'm obviously not a Trump supporter, but I tend to be disassociated with politics in general. Not that I don't believe, well, I don't think that the political structure as is necessarily works, right? And when I have friends who stand up and say, Bernie, 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 and he's going to change everything, I was like, yeah, that whole white messiah thing didn't work for me before. So I'm just going to have to pass on that, not pass on some of the ideas and the ideology, but I have to take a look at what's happening in the background. And it's unfortunate because I think the Pope winds up seeing or being a victim of the same thing. Even if he wanted to change all of the Vatican or change Catholicism as a whole, monolithically, and say, no, we're going to make this massive shift. You've got to take a look at his seat and take a look at the synod and everything else that goes with it and say, that won't change overnight. And he still has to stand in support of all of that, just like Bernie, should he become president, will have to find ways to reduce the level of change that he's committed to, right? So they both find themselves in very interesting parallel.
They're not going to be able to function with autonomy.
That's right.
The phenomenon, I call it Bernie Christ, and there's a lot that I do like about Bernie Sanders. I totally resist this nearly fanatical. Now, again, I always have to stop and say, if you are an enthusiastic supporter, and that's it, I'm not talking about you.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the Bernie Christ people who are, Bernie will save us all, he will cure all our ills. All we have to do is get him elected and the world changes. And I think, and the world has never worked like that.
Right.
He would face a mountain of opposition. Again, we're looking at the arena of compromise and whatnot. There are some who would say that with the white Messiah comment that you're actually using race as a criteria to discount Bernie. I mean, are you being racist about Bernie Sanders?
I say that kind of tongue in cheek.
No, okay.
I'm
playing devil's advocate here, but I mean, does color speak to whether or not you think he would be an effective champion for basic human rights across the color spectrum?
The first response that just jumps out is like, how effective do you think Bernie Sanders would be if he was black?
I really don't know.
Nobody thinks about it. It's like,
I really don't know.
He would not have the platform that he has right now, and was like, no, it's not the next Obama. When I take a look at what we have out there in terms of candidates, I would actually say that a lot of his policies relate more to African Americans than anything else. When we take a look at minimum wage, that's a black issue. When we take a look at incarceration and the industrial complex that is prisons, that's a black issue. Now, it's not a black issue because blacks make it a black issue. It's a black issue because of the historical policies that have been there, right? Michelle Alexander likes to talk about the new Jim Crow. It's like, I don't think it's the new Jim Crow. We're still in the umbra of the old Jim Crow. It hasn't been that long. And for many in America, it's like, okay, we have the Civil Rights Movement, okay, all done, just because the Civil Rights Act was passed. Like, no, all that did was stop people from legally lynching folks that wanted to go vote. We still have people alive today that would absolutely go to a picnic lynching after a Sunday service now. Like I said, I was at a Trump rally just a couple weeks
ago. Yeah, you got that vibe?
I absolutely got that vibe. When I went there, I was like, okay, this is interesting, you know? And then as there was one small eruption while he was speaking, small protest, and it was a small Latino contingent that was there. And like I said, I was the only black person in there, and I'm shooting some of this, and there's this eruption that happens, and then they get escorted out, and I've got my camera, and then people are looking at me funny, and I'm like, oh, I have a camera, right? It's like, please. And I did have a friend that went with me, but I totally got that vibe, especially with so much, there was anti-immigration speech there. There was hate speech there. There was anti-legal immigration conversations that were happening, right? It's like, I understand if you want to argue the illegal stuff. I mean, that's a valid discussion.
It's a discussion worth having.
Right,
sure.
Exactly. But saying, no, we need to build a wall to keep them out. It's like, what do you mean them?
Well, you know, back to Trump, I'm astounded by this weird binary approach that the entire Trump culture, for lack of a better word, is taking toward ISIS. Like, ISIS has hard geographic borders that can be carpet bombed and then ISIS goes away. It's a bizarre approach to essentially an idea that is spread across the globe.
Yeah.
You know, these cells of radicals that won't be taken out by a single surgical strike or even 100 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there isn't a time when force is necessary, but I think to myself, you know, you can wave. People want an easy answer, man. They want it to fit in the cookie cutter. They want it over tomorrow so they can go back to watching their favorite shows on television. And how do you affect change in a culture, an entertainment-based culture, that prides itself in its own ignorance about the rest of the world? You know, what happens over there? You know, tough for them. Syrian refugees, tough for those folks, you know. Weren't born here. I mean, I feel bad for you, but...
And let's also ignore the fact that we helped create ISIS and ISIL.
That we helped to create the vacuum that ISIS then came in to fill.
Yeah.
Do you think the United States has a real culpability for being an agent of destructive power? I mean, do you want to talk about our responsibilities in regard to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, whatever?
I think it's kind of hard to ignore it. Especially with my background, I understand what the real non-conspiratorial dealings that America had with Haiti, specifically that island, and what's come to pass. I understand that the Duvalier regime was kept in power for quite a long time, not specifically because of Haitians and some of the indigenous people that were still left there, but because they were propped up by the American government. So it's very difficult for me to, as someone here, to ignore that. And I tend to believe that I spend more time looking, because I do travel, and I wish more Americans would do that. I wish more Americans would just leave the country, go on vacation for a week, and say, okay, America's the greatest country in the world. Okay, leave that for like 48 hours. Just don't say it.
Instead of looking through the windows and tapping on the glass, you go and experience.
Go and experience it.
Some of the rest of the planet.
Exactly. So you could still come back and say it, right? Because when you start taking a look at our freedoms, who's got this level of freedom, right?
Some people resist that. You know, they say they equate patriotism with blind nationalism.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
You love your country, it automatically means you think everybody else is second class. And I resist that totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I can love my country and want the best for my country. I can be a citizen of the U.S., but also be a citizen of the world. Mm-hmm. It's of the world is the part that seems to so often get forgotten out there.
Well, yeah. And I think that also talks to the resistance to any kind of change. And it's not just blind nationalism that we have, which is also, I think, what Trump feeds on, right? When you take a look at power, white power, not necessarily in the race.
No,
of white
I understand
power,
the context you're using that phrase. Yes, yes.
But
it's kind of a tribalistic thing.
It is very tribalistic.
It's there's an us and there's a them, and as long as there's an us and an in group, there will always be the out group, right?
Yeah, it's funny because we're talking about social justice, and there's this attack on PC culture, right? It's like. And there's the PC police that is out there. And Trump always talks about, you know, the PC, you know, I will not be PC. I will not be PC. And I have had some evangelical friends that have mentioned, you know, he is here because of PC police. I was like, no, he's here because the PC culture hasn't been effective in addressing a lot of the hatred and the tone. But then you talk about tone, and you have white people that will say, and this is why it's complicated, you don't tell me what I can and cannot say. I'm an American. I get to say and do whatever I want. Like, right, but you don't get to call me, yes, I do. And that's where we keep coming back to. Where do we push that standard? And we keep talking about what progress is, and we can measure some of it in feet. But when we start talking about words, we're still measuring that in inches. You shouldn't still be asking whether I can or can't call myself the N-word. You shouldn't want to. We should really be talking about moving the standard beyond that, and we're not. And I think that's probably one of the more base measurements that we can use to see exactly what kind of progress we have made.
Do you respond to the "we are all Africans" narrative? We're all the human race. There is one race. Do you think there's merit in looking at, do you like black or African-American? Because that's a conversation, right?
That is.
Call us black, no, call us African-American. And I'm like, oh, shit, which one do I use? Because I just, whatever's right, right?
Whatever's right.
I mean, what's the move, man?
So the problem is...
I just opened up Pandora's box, didn't I? Yeah.
And this talks about even the tribalism that we see that's inherent to just being human, right? Even if you got rid of race, you would still have the blue eyes versus the brown eyes, right? I deal with that at home with, believe it or not, and talk about colorism. I deal with that with, I have kids who have blue eyes and I have kids who have brown eyes. And I see the different ways that family members approach them. And I'm like, are you really doing this?
Wow.
Are you really, really doing this with my kids?
Are we that eager to divide over these sort of superficial things?
And I'm looking, and I was like, same mommy, same daddy. Brown eyes, blue eyes.
I mean, I have fantasized about the Coca-Cola commercial where we're all holding hands and singing in perfect harmony, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a beautiful idea. I love
the idea that we stop finding all these crazy excuses to be in groups and out groups and see the beauty in, you know, when I was a believer, if you were gay, you might as well have been radioactive.
Yeah.
And then my best friend comes out in the 90s as gay. I have no idea. Which we were very close. It's just a secret he kept that well. And I look at my life now and I think, you know, had I not seen him as just a member of the human race who happened to be different than me and good for him, I would have cheated myself out of the opportunity to have the color that is his life in mine.
Yeah.
His differences make my life better, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've discovered the world, man. And you probably see quite a bit of that. People who, once they start to drop the labels, they discovered beauty they never saw existed before, outside and within themselves. I know it sounds like a freaking Hallmark card, but that's kind of how I feel about it, you know?
I got to tell you. So African-Americans, yes, but that's only a very narrow piece of America. Because that doesn't talk to the Afro-Latinos and the other Afro-Caribbean nations and immigrants who are here, and I represent some of that. And so, yes, my children may be African-American, et cetera, but that's not all they are. So it's too narrow for them specifically. I'm not discrediting or discounting African-American. I'm just saying there's more to it. And so when you start talking about just using the word black is significantly more encompassing, but are we more than just a color, which is, you know, the other part of the narrative? Yes, I'm more than a color. I'm culture, but I'm a mix of such. The fact that my wife's family has no blue eyes whatsoever, yet my children do, indicate something in me, right? Which shows that I am more than just brown eyes and brown skin. I have history there, which I happen to know. So I am more than just a black person. I am a culmination of my experiences, culture, and everything I'm exposed to. I am me. And I bust many narratives, and I'd like to think that many people break those narratives as well. So I look forward to being able to disband and destroy those narratives altogether. But for that to happen, and this is something that I don't think many people really addresses, you have to get rid of the other color too. So you can't hold on to your whiteness and then try and define my blackness, which is something that didn't exist. I didn't know I was black until you told me you were white. So we can't just dismantle one without dismantling the other.
Let's finish with a positive.
Yeah.
You must hear from people who have seen you kind of help break through the wall, right? I mean, Ebony Magazine had to scrape around and all of a sudden they find this one guy.
Yeah.
Right? And now there's more. I mean, there's not a ton more.
What? There's more.
We are seeing the rise of black secularism.
There's more. So we're not there yet, but Because when I take a look at the Eris polls and Pew numbers, I spend way too much time doing it. But when I look at them, they don't show a decrease. Everywhere else, we see a decrease in religiosity. We're not seeing so much in the African-American numbers right now. But we are seeing significant amount of visibility within the secular movement and even outside of the secular movement, where you're seeing more and more African-Americans who claim non-religious, just generally just non-religious. And I think that's great. That will bring forth the tipping point where you can actually see those numbers begin to grow. So we've got these big magnets that are forming. A few years ago, when you Googled African-American or black atheist, that was it. That was it. Much shorter hair, a lot less gray, but this is it. You Google that now, it's like I'm on page 3. I'm like, and that makes me so happy. I mean, seriously. I mean, I've been brought to tears. I'm like, I'm not for a page anymore. Google, yes.
Other people probably harbored those doubts and desires to challenge long before they could ever go public. But the idea of you and others like you being public.
Yeah.
They see your face, they hear your voice, and they're like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Maybe I can do this too.
Yeah. Mandisa is my favorite. Mandisa's like, yep, Mandisa, you have Sikuva on the other side. You have Bree. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, how? I don't even have to talk anymore.
Yeah.
You all have this just so covered. I'm just going to go on vacation.
So you've got some optimism about the days, the months, the years ahead.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we're beginning to see a spillover. And I think the spillover is natural, where it's not just within the secular movement, but you're seeing it cross into politics. You're beginning to see it in just African-American communities in general. You're seeing it in interfaith dialogue that the secular movement isn't always invited to. Mm. Not that we don't always participate, but we're not always invited to it. But, you know, if you show up on an interfaith panel and they don't know you're an atheist because you're black, and you start speaking, oh, no, I happen to be an atheist, but who invited him? It's too late. He's already here. What are you going to do?
And he won't be silenced.
And he won't be silenced. Yeah. But even within other more active movements, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and various other social justice movements, we're seeing people who reject theism, reject Christianity, and they're not afraid of saying that they do. And that's really encouraging, because now we can say that you're actually doing more because you're motivated to do more by you intrinsically, and you're not doing it for goodness. You're doing it for goodness' sake and not for God's.
That's awesome. You're making a difference, Alex. I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. I'll see you back here Tuesday of next week as we talk to Q from Star Trek. We're going to talk to God. It's John DeLancey. Going to be a great one. I'll see you next Tuesday on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast.
Follow the Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.